Hello, everybody. This is The One. I am Greg Gutfeld, otherwise known as The One. I'm here with one of my favorite people, Dr. Drew Pinsky. You see him a lot on our show, but you've known him forever. He has been in a ton of different shows. If you remember Loveline, which offered medical and relationship advice, I have friends that were absolutely addicted to it. Then he was Celebrity Rehab, you know that. And there was Sober House and Sex Rehab, which I was not allowed to participate in. And, of course, he hosted Dr. Drew On Call. And then I believe he's still hosting, and he is hosting Dr. Drew Midday Live with Lauren Savant. Is that still going on, Dr. Drew?
Still going on, The One.
Okay, good. Thank you. I just wanted to make sure, because you're all over the place.
I had to addict people to the previous radio, earlier, the Loveline radio show, and then get involved in treating their addiction.
Exactly. By the way, we're going to get into drugs, addiction, and all that sort of stuff. But I wanted to start with just some topical things, because when I never get a chance to talk to you at length about things. You come to the green room before the GG show. And we talk about stuff, but we can't get in depth into the things that we want to talk about. And we were talking, I think, at some point about the recent shooting, mass shooting, and all the variables that people talk about, whether it's too many guns, not enough security, the effect of video games. My thing, which I always talk about, is the effect of the media spotlight, which I believe creates copycats. And then there's other things like social status inequality, which these days everybody can see that everybody else is better off on Instagram. So I was just interested. You are a person that deals with patients all the time. You deal with people who are mentally ill, who have addictions. What's your sense of what's going on in this kind of phenomenon?
Yeah, there are sort of three things that keep recurring to me. Mm-hmm. One is we have been through a pandemic of childhood trauma and adverse childhood experiences. Mm-hmm. Finally, the medical community is beginning to talk about that. You referenced Loveline, and that's all I talked about every night, every caller. Anybody who was having behavioral or interpersonal relationship problems, it was because of their childhood trauma that they're reenacting the trauma in their young adult life.
Right.
And when you've been traumatized, you can't regulate aggression. You can't regulate emotion. You can't regulate what we call affect. If you don't have a dad, you especially can't regulate aggression. So there's now two issues. Mm. Adverse childhood experiences, absence of the dad. Third issue, those kids that have had adverse experiences are often bullied. And bullying is sometimes the inciting influence in all of this. And then there's a fourth layer, which is denial by the parents, which to me is one of the most disturbing parts of all. These kids give ample opportunity for intervention. They tell you what's going on. And the parents, essentially themselves, of course, possibly products of trauma, but themselves not properly educated, in denial, narcissistic, think to themselves, not my kid. And that is the most dangerous words that a parent can utter.
Wow. You know, when you mentioned, too, the idea of the absence of the dad, I think I see that, what you're talking about, a lot in terms of when you're in public areas, whether it's restaurants or malls, and you watch people who do not react in a civil manner to things that happen. They either react violently. I always assume that's the case, is that they haven't learned how to react to adverse situations.
Well, it's that, and it's often males, right, because males have more aggression. Mm-hmm. And they act out accordingly. And when your dad is not there, strangely, there's a lot of cognitive psychology that shows that dad sort of represents the ambient culture. Dad sort of represents society. Mm. And when dad abandons, you're pissed at everybody. You're pissed at society, and there is no sort of sense that there should be restraint on that because dad wasn't there to teach you that.
Wow, yeah, that makes total sense. What's your take on the, you know, somebody you might be aware of named Scott Adams? We talk about him a lot.
Greg, my partner on radio, Lauren Savant, who, by the way, was the person that said me too in relation to the mm-hmm. Weinstein stuff.
Right.
She's the one that he expressed his affection for into a potted plant.
Right.
And she was one that said, yeah, that happened to me. She'd been talking about it for a long time, but nobody listened.
Right.
But she says that you and I have been actually hypnotized by Scott Adams.
I
believe it too, because 8 minutes don't go by that his name doesn't come out of my mouth.
It's not so, you know why? It's because he has effectively predicted so many things that you have to admit
right.
it. And now he's been talking about – he said this before about video games and how even though the research – even though the research isn't there in terms of influencing these mass – shootings because you would see, I think, more of them than you do now. He says that video games put the idea front and center in your head, which I believe is the case with the media coverage. The media coverage, by producing infamy for the killer, encourages further infamy among people seeking such things. So in a weird way, video games in the media are contributing in a similar way.
I think they're two different things. Mm-hmm. One is sort of a contagion, which is the media, which is spreading the infecting agent. Mm-hmm. And the other is cultivating the soil for violence. And what Scott said, of course, I am aware of what you're talking about, is that he's not worried about the average kid becoming violent. The kids that are already at risk, now bringing that into their consciousness and then desensitizing them to violence. And he's right on that. And that's why the research is sort of, again, I'm not sure if this is my hypnotized self or my clinical self.
Yes.
But the research is pretty muddy on this, and mm-hmm. I think it is because it separates out.
Right.
I certainly see at-risk kids spending too much time obsessing with video games, and I don't know, you know, to me it's multifactorial. They're isolating, they're depressed, they're trying to regulate their affect by going out into this fantasy world. The fantasy world involves violence. They get desensitized to violence. They're not relating to people and developing empathy. So it has many layers to it, and that's why the research is sort of, I'd say, inconclusive or flawed, because they're just looking at one thing, which is the violence.
Yeah. You know, I was reading a couple years ago, it was Robert Cialdini. I think that's his name. He wrote a book called Influence, another persuasive kind of expert in persuasiveness. And he had talked about this research on well-publicized suicides and how they lead to a dramatic uptick in suicides in the area. I mean, and so police, in response, often downplay teen suicides for that reason. Shouldn't that also be maybe a suggestion in dealing with these mass shootings, is to play down the coverage, or no?
I don't know how you do that.
Yeah.
I think, you know, it's about, like anything, it's consuming, you know, for kids. Again, it goes back to parenting, of course, and families. If you are worried as a parent, consume the media with the child, ask questions, process it with them. But of course, the ones that are truly at risk are the ones that don't have that.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it may be naive, Greg, to sort of focus on the contagion, because kids that are really at risk are going to glom on to any of these sort of culturally available, let's call them memes, cultural memes, to act out their distress. And whatever is in the ambient culture becomes the means by way they act it out. And we are in a situation now where this little outbreak, it's an outbreak, and I think of it like an infectious disease, like any other infecting agent. And, you know, how do you contain it? Well, sometimes you can't contain the disease. You have to go, you know, work at the things that predispose to getting the infecting agent, and, you know, acknowledging when there's evidence of the disease. Same model. If you have somebody that's having an outbreak, you deal with it effectively and quickly. You develop means for treating it. It just needs to be dealt with like an infectious disease, in my humble opinion.
If the person that is infected, can a person –
let me just say, Greg, it's like saying – what you're suggesting is like saying, well, we have an infectious disease and it's spreading by people who get on a plane. We better stop flying airplanes. Well, you can't. It's the same idea. We got to deal with it, screen for people that are getting on the plane, recognize it when they get off, recognize it when they start developing the rash or whatever it is. It's just the world we live in.
Well, how dare you use a metaphor against me? I shall return that metaphor and say, what if the plane just decides not to fly in an area that has a lot of Ebola? Like, so to say, like to say to a cable news station, of course you can keep reporting on this, but you don't need to name the person. You don't need to talk about all of the elements of that. You don't need to create a celebrity profile of a mass killer.
I'm modestly in agreement, and I would 100% agree that if there were a localized outbreak, but the outbreak is all over the country and you can't really isolate it. That again, keeping with the infectious disease metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
But think about it. Can you remember the name of a mass killer from a year ago? I can't remember, other than Adam Lanza, because that was a threshold event, in my humble opinion.
Yeah.
That we were in a new world because of that kid, and we didn't realize it, and that he brought us there. But the rest of them, I don't remember.
I mean, we remember the Columbine ones because I guess
I don't remember their names. They are the Columbine ones. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know what I mean? We move on to the next thing. We don't. But we do remember the behavior.
It's
that's what's unfortunate.
You know, there was a recent shooting last week is it called Doral? Is it Doral, Florida? I've been there. Where the guy, he was an adult, like he might have been in his 40s, who showed up at one of the Trump golf clubs and started firing. And all of his cohorts were like, or friends were like, this was shocking. So it was almost like he wasn't part of the group that would normally be infected. Is it possible that somebody can be, and an idea can be planted in somebody's head that didn't exist there before, and then it becomes all-consuming?
Yeah, but I would argue that, say, the mass shooter in Las Vegas is a wholly different phenomenon.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, we're really talking about adolescent, young adult sort of behavior when you talk about that infecting process.
Yeah.
I think this is, you know, this is the mental health crisis in our country, and the fact that nobody's allowed to get people to treatment. It's why we have homelessness scattered. I mean, Los Angeles, come out here.
It's amazing.
You can't. It's unbelievable.
It is.
It's unbelievable what's going on here.
All right, then I want to shift it to my theory about how we've really screwed up the mental health problem here, and you tell me if I'm off base or not. It was probably in the late 60s.
just plant any idea.
Yes, exactly. Now I'm off. In the late 60s and early 70s, we decided, and it was in the media, that asylums and mental institutions were horrible places. And maybe a lot of them were because they were
–
what happened
– Let me break that down a little bit.
Sure.
Because there's profound misconception about what happened. Everyone goes, Reagan closed the psych hospitals. It's like, no. That is not at all what happened. Mm. It actually started with John Kennedy, who started saying – he didn't take massive action, but he started saying, you know, we have these new medications now. At that time, it was Thorazine.
Right.
Let's create forces that help develop community-based mental health systems and get these people out of the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my profession enthusiastically embraced this, and it really was the advent of the sort of the decade of the brain that happened in the decades, the 80s and 90s, when psychotropic medications exploded, and the enthusiasm for it in my profession suggested that it's draconian to hold people, and then the legal profession, of course, jumped right on board that. Yes, you can't restrict people's their personal privileges. And we have these medicine now, and they'll take the medicine, they'll return to work and be productive. Well, it turns out that was grotesquely oversimplified excessively enthusiastic. And the reality is some people, chronically mentally ill, need structure and a high degree of structure sustained throughout their lifetime. And if you don't have family and you don't have resources, the government needs to provide that.
Mm-hmm.
And we are just waking up to that again. In the meantime, slowly but surely, the hospitals became worse and worse places to work. They became more broken down. The staff became worse and worse because no one wanted to work there.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually they were sort of – they were all just shuttered, and that was that.
Yeah. And you know, it's I when you think of mental health – mental institutions, you just think of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And so,
well, unfortunately, that movie did more to harm mental health than anything else because that's exactly where people's heads go. And the reality is almost no hospitals were like that.
Yep.
And these people need an environment to live. It's funny. I talk to homeless people regularly that have recovered and returned to work. First of all, they're furious that people let them live out on the street and didn't go force them to get some treatment because that is suffering. That's misery.
Mm-hmm.
And then they will often say to me, you know, I know how to solve this problem. Here's what you do. You force us into treatment. You take us to a place where there's four walls and a bed. And there should be nurses and doctors and social workers and vocational rehabilitation specialists. I'm like, yeah, that's a psychiatric hospital.
Yes.
Exactly what you need.
Yeah.
It's exactly what you need.
Yeah.
And they're like, yeah, okay, we'll call it something different, but we'd go there. So that's what we need.
And it is a travesty. I'm in a complete agreement with you. When I grew up in the Bay Area. You can't go to San Francisco anymore without something shocking happening to you in front of you. Last time I was there, I won't get into the details, but some man did something in front of my family, which should be done indoors, usually in a bathroom. And
that is what are you talking about? Yeah. That is just riding the BART. Are you kidding?
Yeah, yes.
That's part of every morning. That's ridiculous. Usually it will involve their genitalia and things too. And it's out of control.
Yeah.
And believe me, these people aren't happy living like that.
No. And it's there are people, I don't know if I would call them progressives, who believe that, you know, you should. Everybody has a right to be mixing with the population. So you put these incredibly unstable people with a healthy population, which harms both.
There,
but that's your right.
There actually are finally some sane politicians in San Francisco that are, and in California, a couple of them, that are starting to put forward legislation that would expand the definition of gravely disabled, where we could begin to pull people in because they are completely detached from reality and need help. And even we can't even do that for medical illness now. That's how insane it's gotten. California is just a mess. I don't know if you've been here lately, but it is a freaking mess.
No, I have. And the last time I was in an off-ramp somewhere around Silver Lake was like – it was more like – it was like a national park, the amount of tents.
So That's right. So here's the reality. What you missed is because you got to go up and look closely on either side of those encampments, and they are sometimes thousands of people in a vicinity. On either side is gigantic dumps, huge mounds of feces, thousands of syringes from the IV drug users, and rodents outnumber the people at least 10 to 1.
Ugh.
Those rodents in Southern California carry disease. Mm-hmm. There's going to be a major infectious disease outbreak this summer. We already have norovirus breaking out from the volatilized presence of the feces itself. It actually gets into the air.
Right.
But when the fleets get the rickettsial disease and it gets onto our pets, that is, I mean, how much more of a failure of government can we have than sanitation?
It's insane.
Think about that.
You are not the first person to say you actually no. You, I think you might have mentioned this to me in the green room about this rise of infectious disease,
and then
like 2 days or 3 days later, I read like three articles on this predicting that there's going to be epidemics unless
it has to be.
Yeah.
It has to be.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I mean. We discovered this in the Middle Ages. How the importance of sanitation. And you talk about the abject failure of government. Our roads don't work.
Mm-hmm.
They are actually slowing us down. The roads are in such decay that a horse can barely navigate them. They don't work because they're overcrowded. And we have major they can't protect the population from lack of sanitary environment. That's just such an abject failure of government. I can't get my head around it.
You know, it sounds like you're about to move.
Well, funny you would say that. People are fleeing California right now, and it's the only thing that makes. When I was in New York for your show last week, I thought maybe I could move out here. It makes me feel good to think about it. I literally get relief of how I'm feeling to think in terms of moving.
Yeah,
and you know, New York, the tax structure is not that different, but you get a ton for it here. Look what we get.
Yeah.
We get a dangerous environment.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy. And I mean, by the way, New York does have a homeless problem, but they have
they're
been pretty swift.
It. They're managing it. They are. It's always going to be around, but they're managing it.
Yeah.
And believe me, if you live in New York and you think that's an unmanaged homelessness problem, that looks like nirvana to a Los Angelian.
Yeah. You know, it was around Penn Station. There was briefly like a tent city, and even a left-wing communist like de Blasio realized in order for him to exact the kind of, you know, foolish causes he wants to chase, he has to deal with this. Like, it's the same thing with crime. It's like, if you want to be a progressive in New York, you got to be hardcore on crime and hardcore on like making the city look good. So he has realized that you have to do something. You know, L.A., you don't have to. It's weird. It's like, is it because L.A. is so big and everybody's in their cars, so nobody's walking around? Is that it? I don't know.
No, it's not that. It's just sort of the way our government is structured with a city council and a county supervisors and then a mayor and a mayor who's got his focus on the White House and seems to be completely unconcerned with Los Angeles. It's weird.
Yeah.
But that's where we're at.
You know, another thing that we talk about in the green room that you kind of you made me very like it's something when you told me something I hadn't heard before. We were talking about the opioid crisis and epidemic. And I'm always coming from, as you know, I come from the position of like we should be going after the problem and not the patients. And, you know, sure, there's an abuse, but, you know, there are cancer patients, there are pain patients. But you said something to me that I hadn't heard about, which changes a little bit of the way I look at things. And you alerted to me about how opioids and pain medications change the body's relationship to pain so that you may not know – like the patient may not know – if they are truly in pain or not, right? Or is that my –
let me make it more explicit.
Yeah.
There is literally no or no good evidence, at least, that opiates are a treatment for chronic pain.
Mm-hmm.
Let me state it again.
Yeah.
The science suggests that opiates are not a treatment for chronic pain. And we read the book Dreamland. Please, everybody, read Sam Quinones' book or Greg interview him. It nailed it. I lived through it, and he spotted it and nailed what happened. It does not treat it. In fact, makes chronic pain worse. Mm. It creates chronic withdrawal, which is back pain.
Right.
And it's going to kill people when they add in the benzodiazepine. So here's how it works. Mm-hmm. You have some chronic pain syndrome.
Right.
You get an opiate. It works for a little while, and then the pain starts getting worse. It causes something called hyperalgesia. Pain gets worse, so you start upping the dose. Now you're in chronic withdrawal all day, and you get back pain on top of it. Mm-hmm. Every person on opiate has back pain. That is withdrawal. That's what I dealt with all my heroin addicts.
Right.
Trust me, it's withdrawal. Mm-hmm. Now you start taking pain for medicine for the back pain. Well, they've recently shown data, much to, you know, I'm stunned that it took a while for them to get the literature out on this, but I've been seeing it forever. People on opiates, because they're in chronic withdrawal, can't sleep, feel anxious. Now they get put on a benzodiazepine medication. 96% of deaths for people on OxyContin and other oral opiates, 96% included another agent, typically a benzodiazepine.
Mm.
So the combination of a benzodiazepine and opiate and a pharmaceutical opiate is a lethal combination, and it's prescribed all the freaking time.
Yeah.
I can't understand why it's done. So you have people in chronic withdrawal, intensified pain, and then if you're an addict on top of that, again, if you have that genetic potential for addiction, now that takes off, and that starts driving everything.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a multifactorial mess.
Yeah.
And no clinical evidence that it should be used.
That's amazing.
It's ridiculous.
So let me ask you, because whenever I listen to you, I always consider you to be somewhat of a libertarian because of your
– I am.
Yeah.
I am, although I've gotten so – people keep pointing out to me that I keep talking about solving problems like the homeless thing. And they go, really? You want the government to do that, Mr. Libertarian? And I go, yes, I do. I'm sorry. I want to fix it.
Well, the thing is, I'm a libertarian until I talk about national defense, and then I'm a hawk, and then people throw me out of the room. But would you ever consider legalization?
Of what?
Because you're talking of all drugs? Yeah. Or what?
I'm sort of agnostic on that a little bit.
Yeah.
I've always been kind of that way. I mean, I have felt that, you know, if you really study the history of our drug laws, it's bizarre.
Yeah.
It all came out of the Harrison Narcotic Act, which really was a response to doctors. Again, the last big opioid epidemic we had was in 1890, and it was in response to the doctors overprescribing opiates and giving opiates as a chronic treatment for drug addiction. That's really what they were trying to intervene upon.
Wow.
There was a subsequent interpretation of the law, Webb versus something, where it became even more draconian and more sort of universal. And then in 1970s under Nixon, it became bizarre, frankly. It became like ridiculous, where now we can't even touch chemicals, just a molecule that might be helpful to humanity because somebody decided that's an evil molecule. That's bizarre to me.
Yeah, no, I think so too. It's just that, you know, like there's me, I believe you should have a right to relief and a right to oblivion, and no one should tell you what you could put in your own body. But then if you drive down, you know, I don't know, Highland or wherever in L.A. and you see the detritus and you go like, okay, you have to be able to accept that, you know, knowing that like, okay, there's a large – there's a sizable part of the
population. Here's how you balance it. I'll tell you, you're struggling with it. Let me balance it out very quickly for you, which is do whatever you want, everybody. But once you get to the point where you're not in your right mind and the condition you're in is associated with crime and homelessness, we can come get you and treat you.
Yeah, that's good.
We can help you at that point.
I like that balance. Yeah. I like that balance. And I think, you know, I honestly don't think it's that inexpensive. I mean, that expensive. If to say you just – like there's so much land in this country. You can build a facility and you can send people there. It doesn't have to be in New York City. It doesn't have to be in L.A. But you get on a bus. You go to some affordable area in Texas or in New Jersey or upstate New York. And, you know, it's – I don't understand why I don't know. There's no progress in this. You know, I have a question for you. Here's a real weird question before I got to wrap it up. So people have a right not to be treated. They can deny, if a doctor gives a prescription, he doesn't have to take it. I don't want your opiates.
I'm not a legal expert on this, but there's boundaries on that. Like you can't be a child and
how about
in danger, that kind of thing.
How about the opposite? Could you pose an idea that you can eliminate prescriptions because they interfere with the right to care?
Could you can put everything over the counter?
Everything over everything over the counter. I listened to a podcast of the a libertarian talking about this, and it was pretty convincing the way she
Econ Talk. What are you listening to? I got to pick it up.
It was, I think it was in something called is it called Rational? The Rational Thinker. I'll send it to you. But I was like, I'd never heard of this idea. But the idea that, like, no prescriptions, everything OTC, because you have a right to – if you can refuse care, you can also demand care.
Let me tell you, it makes me cringe a little bit because I know in order for people to manage that, we must educate them. And yeah. Our biological and science education is unbelievably inadequate. Yeah. And yet everybody thinks they're an expert. My peers have begun to hang little frames in their office that says, please do not confuse your Google search with my medical training. And remember, there's a fear of expertise. People don't like experts, so they're right. going to make their own decisions. It could be a disaster. But I think more than a libertarian, I'm a pragmatist. Mm-hmm. And so if we could really study it and look at it and it didn't hurt people and we could properly educate them, I don't in principle disagree with it. I just see a massive pragmatic problem. Because of our failure to educate.
Yep.
Really, that's underlying it. You can't trust people to make good decisions with this or to go to the right experts to get – they don't even know what that means.
Right. And, you know, Google –
they don't know what that means.
Google is the worst place to go to when you have a symptom, because then everything leads to cancer, no matter what it is.
Please understand that what you can find online is essentially everything I knew at the end of my second year of medical school. Then I spent the next 18 years applying that knowledge and developing expertise and wisdom. Mm-hmm. And it's that 18 years of experience with that information in a clinical setting that you see me for, so I can make the correct judgment, mm-hmm. the correct call for your particular clinical situation.
Yeah. So I will not ever search anything on Google again, because all it does
call
is
me. DM me.
Yes. So, Dr. Drew,
my DMs.
where can our aside from seeing you on my show here and again, where can our listeners find you?
The best thing is go to drdrew.com. All my kind of pods and things are there. If you're in Los Angeles or San Francisco, I'm on KGO in San Francisco in the afternoon, and KBC in Los Angeles. And working on a couple of TV projects with millennials, of all things, where these kinds of issues are being sort of hashed out. We'll see.
Ah, excellent. Well, good luck with that. Those millennials, they're hard to deal with.
Oh, man. I spent the weekend doing a pilot with them, and it was worse than I thought. Particularly as it pertains to this issue of expertise.
Yes.
They literally think they're experts on everything. I mean, literally.
Oh, like, I see it all the time. They never ask anybody for advice.
No, because they know.
Yes.
They have questions. They have answers, but no questions.
You know why? Because in their cell phone, they have all the information in the universe. So they don't
right.
like
– But none of the knowledge.
Exactly.
Understand? All the information and none of the applied knowledge. And they don't know the difference.
We're two old people now. We're now officially old people because we're complaining about millennials. Dr. Drew, always a pleasure.
Thank you, my friend. I think it was official when we mentioned Scott Adams.
Yeah. And I'll let him know.
Okay. Thanks.
Take care, buddy.
Right.
Bye.
Yeah, bye.